Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
A good night's sleep is going extinct. The rise of tech and stress in the modern world is keeping people awake. Some are even turning to cat memes to get them through the night. IKEA is here to help with everything you need to build up your rest reserves. Stylish bedding, supportive mattresses, and unique bed frames. So you can stop cat memeing and start cat napping. See what I did there? Discover new ways to save your sleep today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 30th of August, these are our main stories. As the authorities in Hong Kong ban protests and arrest activists, the pro-democracy leaders remain defiant. Thousands of civilians have fled the last rebel-held enclaves in northern Syria as the government continues its bombardment there. Also,
when we fainted, they gave us shocks to bring us back to consciousness. They said, "Do not scream." I told them, "Do not beat us, just shoot us."
Residents of Indian-administered Kashmir say they've been tortured and abused by the security forces. And in this podcast,
there's been a lot of myths and rumours. There are communities who don't believe that Ebola actually exists or kills people. There are communities and individuals in communities who believe that if you get vaccinated, you will die.
The challenges facing health workers trying to contain the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Plus, what happened when a hotel tried to sell off a star's used bedsheets? In the run-up to further planned demonstrations in Hong Kong, the police there have warned that anyone participating in illegal demonstrations will be arrested. And they've banned a planned protest. The regional commander, Kwok Pak Chung, explained why.
According to intelligence we received, some radical protesters are going to make use of every opportunity available to carry out violent behaviour that would seriously threaten public safety. Such behaviour is going to seriously undermine the safety of participants. And all members present, including police officers and members of the press, will see their lives and properties seriously threatened.
Meanwhile, police have also been arresting activists, among them Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow, two leading members of the pro-democracy group Demasisto, who've now been released on bail. Here's a little of what Agnes Chow had to say.
We Hong Kong people won't give up and won't be scared by these white terror and injustice, but we will keep on fighting for democracy and the five demands of Hong Kong people, including a complete retraction of the extradition law, an independent investigation over the police violence, and also the most important thing is the universal suffrage and a democratic political system.
Shortly before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our correspondent in Hong Kong, Stephen McDonnell. So, both Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow have been released, but they've also been charged.
Yes, they have. They are charged in relation to an incident which happened 5 weeks ago when activists surrounded police headquarters as part of this ongoing political crisis here. Now, they are facing charges in terms of inciting others to gather illegally, but also themselves participating in such an illegal gathering. And the police are saying that this is not part of some crackdown on the pro-democracy movement. They say that they collect evidence and when there's enough of it, someone is charged. But there is a perception in the community that there does seem to be a push on to try and grab various key leaders of this movement, because on the same day that they've been arrested, it follows the leader of a banned pro-independence party, Andy Chan, also arrested. Now, he was picked up while trying to board a flight out of Hong Kong. And another local councillor who was involved in the protest movement was also arrested today. So although the police said this isn't some sort of a crackdown on protest leaders, it does seem like a remarkable coincidence that some five key figures have been picked up in the last 24 hours here, and they're not just ordinary protesters, they are, as I say, figureheads of the movement.
And there's also been news, hasn't there? Well, news has emerged on the extradition bill that sparked off these latest protests.
So one of the key demands amongst the protesters is to have this much-hated extradition bill fully and officially withdrawn. Now, the government came out and said it's effectively politically dead and is saying to people, just trust us, we won't bring it back in again. Well, that hasn't been good enough for the demonstrators. They want the bill withdrawn, and they say if the government is to be trusted, that it's never to be reintroduced, why hasn't that happened? Now, according to reports we're seeing today, though, the Hong Kong government asked Beijing if it could actually do this, and Beijing said no. Now, that says a couple of things. One, it says that it seems that the Hong Kong government isn't really capable of making this decision by itself, that word to remove such a bill would have to come from the central government. And it also seems to show that this is some sort of a face-saving option on the part of both Beijing and the government in Hong Kong, because while they say that the bill's not to be ever be reintroduced again, they also don't want people to think that protesting works. And so if they were to remove that bill officially, it would be tantamount to admitting that these mass demonstrations have been effective, that the government was wrong, and it's not something it seems Beijing is prepared to do.
Stephen McDonnell, our correspondent in Hong Kong. As the Syrian government continues its onslaught on the rebel-held areas in the northwest of the country, the humanitarian situation there is becoming increasingly dire. Many people are attempting to flee. The latest figures suggest 7,000 people have managed to do so after days of intense airstrikes. I found out more from our Middle East correspondent, Martin Patience, who spent a lot of time in Syria and who's now in Beirut.
Well, what's happening is the Syrian government, backed up by Russia and Iran, is pushing into the last opposition stronghold in Syria. It's called Idlib. It contains 3 million people, as well as tens of thousands of fighters, many of them hardline Islamists. Now, the Syrian government seems to be focusing on retaking a major highway, which runs from the capital, Damascus, to the second city of Aleppo. That runs through this opposition stronghold. So the latest we have are that 7,000 people have fled from one of the towns, Marat and Numan, one of the towns on that highway, and they push further into the opposition stronghold. Now, the big issue is, as Syrian troops push further into the opposition stronghold, the territory gets smaller and smaller. They can't push into Turkey because the border is closed, and the United Nations is warning of a bloodbath.
And there are also reports, aren't there, of troop movements, but also of a possible Russian ceasefire from Saturday.
That's right. There's a lot of conflicting accounts. We had reports that the Syrian government was putting reinforcements onto the front line. That would suggest that they were going to push perhaps into more towns and villages, and we'd see more fighting in the coming days. But then we've had this surprise announcement. It's been announced by a Russian news agency that Russia, which backs the Syrian government, the Syrian regime, has called for a ceasefire starting from tomorrow. It's calling on the militant groups to put down their arms and adhere to this ceasefire, although it isn't clear whether or not the rebels are going to agree to that. And indeed, what we've seen in the past is ceasefires come and go. So it's difficult to know how significant a development this is at the moment.
Martin Patience, our Middle East correspondent. Two decrees have come into force in Germany, which will make it easier for the descendants of people who fled the Nazis to claim German citizenship. From Berlin, here's Jenny Hill.
As the Nazi regime tightened its murderous grip on Europe in the 1940s, those who fled persecution in Germany were stripped of their citizenship. Under modern German law, they and their descendants have the automatic right to reclaim it. Today, Germany's interior minister announced that the right to citizenship would be extended to cover a number of different circumstances. Horst Seehofer said he considered it a great proof of trust that the descendants of those persecuted by the Nazis wanted to reclaim their German citizenship.
Jenny Hill. In Indian-administered Kashmir, unprecedented restrictions on freedoms have been in place now for 26 days. since the government of India unilaterally withdrew the region's semi-autonomous status. Authorities have arrested as many as 3,000 people, including high-profile politicians, lawyers, journalists and protesters. The government claims their actions are preemptive and designed to maintain law and order in India's only Muslim-majority state. The Indian Army has been fighting a separatist militancy in the region for almost 30 years. With a near-total communication blackout and a ban on all non-Indian journalists entering Kashmir, information about what's been happening on the ground has been slow to emerge. But the BBC has heard multiple accounts of night raids conducted on civilian homes and allegations of brutal beatings and torture. Samir Hashmi has been inside Kashmir, from where he sent this report, some of which you may find distressing.
Friday prayers at the local mosque. Despite a heavy security clampdown, several Muslims in this village have assembled here. We are in South Kashmir to investigate disturbing allegations of beatings and torture. I've come to a village which is 30 minutes away from the main city of Indian administered Kashmir, Srinagar. I'm going to meet two brothers and they have something to tell me.
Assalamu alaikum, my name is Samir.
Wa alaikum salam, Samir bhai.
As I walk into the house, they invite me to their living room. Like all the people we spoke to, they are too scared to reveal their identities. They tell me on the first day of the crackdown, soldiers came banging on their door. They were pulled out of their beds and asked for names of people who throw stones on the security forces. A regular occurrence in Kashmir. Both were allegedly hit with rods and cables for 2 hours. They showed us their injuries.
We were asking them, what have we done? You can ask the villagers. They beat every part of my body. When we fainted, they gave us shocks to bring us back to consciousness. They put mud in our mouths. They said, do not scream, do not scream. Why are you screaming? They did not give us any reason. I told them, do not beat us, just shoot us. I was asking God to take me because the torture was unbearable.
In the same neighborhood, I meet another man who was allegedly tortured on the same night. Still in shock, he shows me pictures of bruises on his leg. He believes he was targeted because he's a Muslim.
They pulled my beard so hard, I felt like my teeth would come out. Then when I became unconscious, one of the boys told me that they tried to burn my beard. But then someone in the army stopped him.
We are told that 13 men from this village were allegedly tortured that night.
These incidents were happening, you know, previously as well, but the frequency of these sequences, these events have increased drastically since.
We spoke to a group of young men who believe the alleged excesses by the security forces will deepen further the mistrust between the locals and the Indian state.
It's only to create fear among the people, nothing else. And if they start beating the people like the way they are doing right now, I think it will lead more alienation, because if we see the history, people who have been beaten by the army, they later on pick up the guns.
We put these claims to the army, who responded with a written statement. The allegations are baseless and unsubstantiated. The Indian army has not manhandled any civilians as alleged. Security forces operate strictly to ensure safety and security of civilians. The Indian Army is a professional organization that understands and respects human rights. Kashmir has been mired in conflict for decades. It's one of the most militarized zones in the world. Many Kashmiris want independence, and since 1989, there has been an insurgency against the Indian state. In many parts of this region, there is huge sympathy for the militant groups who are seen as freedom fighters. I've come to a cemetery here in a village called Karimabad. And at the cemetery, there are 16 people that are buried, and all of them died fighting the Indian military. The whole cemetery is covered with colorful garlands. And there's also a sign on the wall which says Freedom Fighters of Karimabad. A few kilometers away, I meet a man who has a broken leg. He says his brother is a member of a banned militant group. The soldiers allegedly wanted information from him about his brother, who visits the family sometimes.
I held both my hands out and they tied them, and my legs as well. They hung me upside down. They beat me a lot for about 2 to 2.5 hours.
For weeks now, there have been clashes between protesters and security forces in some neighborhoods. Locals throw stones on the security forces. Troops fire tear gas and lead pellets. There is a backlash against the government's decision to revoke the region's semi-autonomous status. But many people across the rest of India have welcomed the decision and praised Prime Minister Modi for the bold move. The government says they are gradually lifting some of the restrictions in Kashmir, but internet and mobile phones remain shut down. Kashmir has been virtually cut off from the rest of the world for almost a month now, and anger is growing.
Samir Hashmi reporting from Indian-administered Kashmir. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World this week. And Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell us what's in the latest edition.
We'll take a closer look at what suspending Parliament in September means for the UK's Brexit battle as it intensifies ahead of the October deadline. We'll hear why there's been heated debate in Kenya over the spoils of oil and who gets to keep the metaphorical leg of the goat. We'll ask what sort of welcome women football fans in Iran are likely to have when they're able to watch their first men's football match in Tehran. And we'll find out more from Paris on why Emmanuel Macron isn't just a dreamer when it comes to leadership in global diplomacy.
Thanks, Caroline. That's all in The World this week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website at www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
The question has never been, are we impacting the environment? It's where, when and how much.
How our distant ancestors may have had far more impact on the Earth than previously realised. It's the second worst outbreak of Ebola in history and the worst ever to have struck the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now the death toll there has reached more than 2,000. It's emerged that a 9-year-old girl from the DRC who'd travelled to neighbouring Uganda has died from the disease. I asked Patience Atuhari, who's in Uganda, to tell us more about this case.
Health officials tell us that she succumbed to Ebola this morning, and both the Ugandan and Congolese officials are trying to find out a way to make sure that her body is safely taken back to the DRC for burial. There has to be a lot of precautions that all officials in the hospital at Bwera, where she was receiving treatment overnight, and across the border in the DRC, precautions that have to be taken to make sure that she's given a decent burial. Her mother, who'd travelled with her, has also been put in isolation, and she will be repatriated to the DRC, but she will continue to be monitored along with other family members.
Do we know how long they'd been in Uganda?
Well, the mother of the girl brought her into Uganda for treatment Thursday afternoon, that's yesterday. At the border where there's a major Ebola screening point at the Ugandan border, she was screened and found to have a fever and very high temperature, so she was immediately put into isolation. And then she was later confirmed to have Ebola Thursday afternoon. And so she hadn't been in Uganda for a long time. And on the Ugandan side, the little girl, the 9-year-old, and her mom did not come into contact with a lot of people. So that sort of minimizes the risk.
And patients across the border in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the death toll from Ebola has now reached more than 2,000, hasn't it? How are they working there to contain this outbreak?
The DRC has had the challenge of the fact that the sheer size of the area. The DRC has also faced the challenge of the fact that in some of these areas, they are fighting groups, they are rebel groups, they are militants, and they've been attacking healthcare workers. And also the other big challenge is that
There's been a lot of myths and rumors. There are communities who don't believe that Ebola actually exists or kills people. There are communities and individuals in communities who believe that if you get vaccinated, you will die. So that's been the biggest challenge.
Patience Atuhari speaking to me from Uganda. In 2011, when street protests forced Yemen's president at the time, Ali Abdullah Saleh, from power, there were hopes that democracy might take root in that country. Instead, violence and chaos followed. In 2014, armed Houthi rebels who'd overrun much of the north and west of the country took over the capital, Sana'a, plunging Yemen into civil war. Since then, surrounding countries have become involved in the conflict, which is thought to have cost around 100,000 lives and left more than 24 million people in need of aid. Mike Thompson met staff at the city's Radio Yemen Times and has this report on everyday life in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a.
Radio Yemen Times, 91.9.
Despite civil war, a takeover by Houthi rebels and bombing by Saudi planes, Sana'a-based Radio Yemen Times has continued to broadcast its special mix of programmes. Chief presenter, Dara Samia.
The radio station started at a time when we were the only one dealing with people's social issues. All the other stations were controlled by the government. The slogan for this radio station was, "Your voice is heard," because we wanted people to talk freely about their daily lives and express what they are going through. Yay! The main issues that people like to talk about are the salaries, peace initiatives, and politics. Though these are subjects that we try to avoid discussing on the radio, because it's risky to talk about the conflict, and we could get arrested for discussing foreign interventions. But it's not just that. We are a radio station that was aimed at fostering harmony and putting a smile on people's faces. So for that reason, too, we avoid politics and try to talk about peaceful topics that bring people together.
Yet that's quite a challenge, given the harsh realities of life on Sana'a's often violent and crime-ridden streets. Daraz's fellow presenter, Sina Halid.
As you know, we are suffering and living a devastating life. Everything is very expensive. And that is all due to petrol being at a very high price. And not everyone can afford to buy food. We don't have electricity. It doesn't exist anymore. People depend on solar panels, and that's also only for people who can afford it.
The numbers of people being kidnapped now is very high because there is no security in Yemen. Women and children in particular are in great danger. Also, most people can't afford to go out now, so people mainly stay at home.
Ala Radio Yemen Times, 91.9.
Salam al ghiab ya wajdan. Salamat, alf salama alaykum.
Yemen Times Radio runs several phone-in programs to help keep in touch with as many as possible of the nearly 4 million people in this Yemen's largest city. Many calls come from students who've given up their studies and joined the army, often due to fears that they'll never find jobs, given the country's perpetual state of chaos.
When a student chooses to put down their pen and pick up a weapon, it's very, very worrying. It means that we are heading into the future as an uneducated nation.
But Daris, who's blind, refuses to be downhearted. He points out that the civil war has brought out the best as well as worst in many people. However bad things get, it seems Daris and his colleagues have no intention of giving up or allowing their listeners to either.
That report by Mike Thompson from Sana'a in Yemen. 10,000 years ago, there were about 5 million people living on Earth, compared to nearly 8 billion today. You might think that their impact before industrialization on the planet was pretty minimal. But researchers say a huge proportion of the land showed the effects of human activity even then, such as herding, hunting and farming. Nicolas Gauthier, a researcher at the University of Arizona, co-wrote the study. And Dan Damon asked him just how far was the global landscape being shaped by our ancestors 10,000 years ago?
The basic story is that it's much more than we would think. And so especially 10,000 years ago, much of the people are practicing some mixed form of hunting, gathering, and some light management of plants that we might call agriculture. And I think the big takeaway is, even though from our modern perspective, these are rather primitive ways of making food, that there's still this really significant modification of the landscape. So through things like fire, clearing forests. So this very low-level food production is still quite widespread and has a really extensive impact on the planet. And then as time comes closer to the present, that only increases with the advent of really serious intensive agriculture.
So what proportion of the planet's surface then was actually being affected by those 5 million humans?
It's hard to say because, especially at, we're looking this far in the past, there's such spotty records, right? So it's easy to look at these large agricultural societies like ancient Egypt, and we can clearly see they built in stone. We can see exactly where they're doing stuff on the landscape. The further you go back in time, the remains become much more ephemeral. And so it's hard to directly detect the aerial extent of this. But from our evidence, we see it's most of the land surface has some form of human modification going on. Very quickly, that begins to switch over to more settled agriculture, starting around 10 or 8,000 years ago.
It is a surprise then, isn't it? Because you'd think that few number of humans would hardly touch the ecology of the planet then, but no.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And we can see analogs even in lots of present day hunting and gathering societies, where in terms of if you go out and look on the landscape, it seems like they have only an ephemeral presence moving from camp to camp. But in reality, there's quite sophisticated management of the local ecology. And so it's less immediately apparent that the human impacts, but they're still there and they're quite strong. The question has never been, are we impacting the environment? It's where, when, and how much.
Nicolas Gauthier of the University of Arizona speaking there to Dan Damon. An exclusive hotel in China has fallen foul of the authorities after trying to auction off the used hotel room complete with bed linen of a very special guest. So, whose was it? Here's our China media analyst, Carrie Allen.
Her name's Karen Mok, and she's probably not known internationally, but she's a big star both in China and Hong Kong. She's a Hong Kong singer. She's got 15 million followers on Sina Weibo. And ever since the 1990s, she's done a lot of acting and singing. So she's very, very well known. And she was staying in a hotel called the Movenpick Hotel in Anshe, an area of Hubei province, which is in central China. And after she vacated her room, the hotel staff decided that they were going to auction the room, and they shared pictures of her room as it was left and said that people could stay and see her used sheets and her used towels.
So, ooh, yuck.
Yeah, quite.
So how did the auction go?
Well, these pictures circulated on social media of the auction posters, and people were furious. They were saying that this was an invasion of her privacy. They were absolutely disgusted by it, and it alerted the authorities, who subsequently said that they were going to investigate the matter. And they've had a stern word with the hotel staff. They've fined the hotel as well, and they've said that they're carrying out an investigation into how this happened.
Kerry Allen, our China media analyst. And that's almost it from this edition of Global News. But before we go, let's hear some of the less reported stories from around the world. Here's Martin Morgan from our monitoring team. And Martin, a football team in Serbia has stirred up unhappy memories, hasn't it, of the violent breakup of Yugoslavia. What happened?
Well, Red Star Belgrade parked an army tank outside its stadium this week to symbolise its slogan, which is "The machine has started up." And this was ahead of an important game. But neighbouring Croatia sees it as a tribute to the Serbian forces that fought against them in those bloody wars in the 1990s. Now, the tank was parked by the stand reserved for Red Star's hardcore nationalist fans. And people on social media soon started claiming that the tank itself was used in the war in Croatia. We don't know whether it was, to be honest. The Serbian authorities haven't really helped matters, though, by issuing contradictory statements about the tank. The Interior Ministry said it's just a replica, you know, a mock-up. Whereas the army says, no, it's a real tank, but it's had its engine removed and its guns removed and so on. Now, the Red Star fans don't see any problem with this. And, you know, they've stuck with the military theme by going on to parade through Belgrade in an armoured personnel carrier yesterday to celebrate they're getting through to the Champions League in Europe by drawing with the Swiss team Young Boys.
Other stories now. A theatre group in Turkey is putting on a play about climate change, but it's not your average troupe of actors, is it?
No, that's right. They're all women from a small village called Aslanköy, and none of them are professional actors. The theatre was set up by Umiye Kuchak, who's a grandmother, and she's been writing and producing plays for years. Now, her latest efforts, called Mother, the Sky Has Been Pierced, and it's being rehearsed, like all her other plays, under a walnut tree in her garden. And people have been inviting the troupe to perform it all over Turkey. It's become quite a big deal. Now, that's possibly because she's already something of a star in Turkey. She's even appeared in a television advert with the footballer Ronaldo. But her plays tackle real issues that affect rural women in particular, like domestic violence and poverty. And women have been using social media in Turkey to encourage other people to follow her example in challenging what are increasingly conservative social attitudes in the country.
And that was Martin Morgan from the BBC's monitoring team. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.